This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
As we drive slowly past the burning house, whenever a siren, police car or fire truck or ambulance would puncture my Saturday morning cartoons, twisting the blue from the sky, my mother would tell me to go start the car. "Let's see what's happening," she'd say. And we'd drive to the place where the sirens called us, to a family huddled in their pajamas on the lawn, just like we'd once huddled. Think of this as our odyssey. Sirens called out to Odysseus as well, to lull him into stranding his ship in the shoals. It could be argued that our sirens were merely calling out to strand us as well, only it would take years to know that that was what they were doing. Or it could be argued that at least it wasn't our tragedy. At least we were able to step outside our house for an hour, into the fresh air, to witness something outside ourselves, to empathize or to practice empathy, even though we never knew the people who'd lived in the burning houses, nor did it seem we cared to, even after their house was gone. What could we have possibly offered? A room in our falling down house? There was no room. A meal, a blanket, some clothes? We never did. What was my mother hoping to find? What was she hoping to see? Was she teaching me to pay attention, close attention to the world as it was, or to pay close attention to the afterworld as it would be? Maybe she believed that she could tell if it was a scam by looking everyone in the eye as they stumbled out of their smoky house. Or maybe she just wanted to make sure all the children made it out okay. Or maybe she wanted me to practice, like other families practice fire drills, so that when the sirens came for her, I'd know what to do. To get into the car and drive toward the sound, whatever it was, fire or heart attack, car crash or suicide. To get out and stand on the sidewalk or on someone's lawn, or to not even stop, to make it a slow drive-by while a stranger is carried away on a stretcher. But where do you drive to when the siren is outside your own house? What do you look at when the strangers on the sidewalk are looking at you?
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 434 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I talk to the poet and memoirist Nick Flynn about his latest memoir, This Is the Night Our House Will Catch Fire, which comes out this Tuesday. That being the Tuesday after this episode drops. You know how time works. I know. So how are you, my friends? Some of you are dealing with the fear and loathing of your kids being on campus somewhere, or being at home, learning as best they can online. I don't envy you that. Since I am voting for them, I treated myself to not watching the convention and instead watched Beyond the Black Rainbow and Guns Akimbo and Jojo Rabbit. That's when I'm not watching the Netflix version of A Series of Unfortunate Events, which stars Patrick Warburton, aka Putty or Kronk, as Lemony Snicket. The aesthetic of the show is Wes Anderson gothic. It has a wonderfully strange pace and tone. I revised one of my poems this week, as it was accepted for eventual publication. That counts as writing, doesn't it? Last night, I replaced a toilet seat cover, which sort of feels like a poem. Like something Bukowski might write, although his poem would be about breaking the toilet seat, probably. I've spoken previously with Nick Flynn back in 2016 on episode 186. That sure is a lot of numbers ago. You know how numbers work. Our subject that time was his poetry collection, My Feelings. We talked in one of the beautiful rooms of the Confucius Institute at Miami-Dade College at Miami Book Fair. Miami Book Fair will be strictly online this year, so those listeners who don't live a drive away from Miami will be able to enjoy it from the comfy of your own pads. I'm planning on a special episode devoted to previewing the fair in November. All right, let's talk to Nick.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is the poet and memoirist Nick Flynn. His memoirs are Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, about a painful reunion with his father when Nick was working in a homeless shelter, The Ticking is the Bomb, about fatherhood and torture, and The Reenactments, about visual disorientation and the adaptation of his first memoir into the excellent film Being Flynn. His breathtaking new memoir is This is the Night Our House Will Catch Fire, about motherhood, suicide, and literally the night his house caught fire when he was a boy. This is the second time Nick and I have conducted an interview, as we spoke at Miami Book Fair International in 2015 on episode 186. Nick, welcome back.
Hi, John. It's so good to see you again virtually.
Yeah. So how's our internment treating you?
We fled. I was teaching in Texas when it hit, when things started to fall apart. I teach a semester down in Houston every spring. And, you know, things, as everyone knows, things sort of were gradually or sort of rapidly, like day to day, unplugging. And I'd come north just because I go back and forth to see my family to Brooklyn. And then just suddenly I wasn't going back. Suddenly, you know, it sort of the options started closing. And then we fled the city. We came upstate. We came up into the country 2 hours north of the city just because, New York got hit really hard, as everyone knows. And it just seemed the safest and actually the most for the good of the whole, to just try to stay away from, to isolate oneself as much as possible. So we've been up here. We haven't really gone back. We've gone back to get our mail to Brooklyn, but yeah.
Yeah, I lived there for 3 years when I was getting my MFA, and that seems like the worst possible place to have to be during a pandemic. Like in Florida, it's like there are no rules and it's like Mad Max, but there's a lot of room. Like the population density isn't scary anywhere near me. And so I kind of feel like I can at least walk away from anybody I want usually. So.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah. In Brooklyn, we're on top. And then, the protests, they've been sort of so wildly active, which is, an amazing moment, in history, historical moment, but it's also coming at this moment too. That's fraught also with the virus still all over. So
congratulations on the new memoir. I say congratulations, even though you're mining a lot of trauma still, but as a writing accomplishment, like it's an artistic accomplishment. So congrats.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, there'll probably be some level of trauma in every book I write. It just seems like, and not to say that, I say maybe even some level of struggle, because just, that is part of life. I mean, struggle is part of life. So, and when you're writing, when you're creating something, it just seems like that's part of the job is to go into those places, those difficult places. So,
but with fiction writing, you can sort of choose where to place those traumas. And I guess you could kind of do the same thing with memoir, which may be why, you know, you tend not to write about these things in a chronological way that is simply point A to point B, but instead it's more impressionistic. I imagine that's both a comforting way to write and also a really complicated way to finish a book, since it seems like you've got to do a lot of weighing about the movements and, you know, the way that the whole book kind of feels, which I know after, I don't know, there's a certain point when I just feel like I've been eating raw hamburger working on my work. And so trying to get a sense of the whole can be really tricky. So can you talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, memoir writing and trying to get the whole thing to feel right with that process?
Yeah, this book, I mean, each book has a different process for me. I sort of let the process sort of organically arise, and sort of like whatever the material requires, I sort of try to follow that as much as possible and not impose a structure on it. And with this one, it really began as like a series of journeys. Like you might have, maybe it's not obvious from the book itself, but it began as a series of journeys back to my hometown with my daughter. When she turned 7, began to ask me questions. She's very curious, and questions about what my childhood was like, what I was like when I was 7. Like that seemed really important to her, like to know what I was doing when I was 7. I found, you know, even though I've written, you know, 3 memoirs now, and I found that I didn't have a lot of memories from that time in my life. There were very few. And the one memory that I had the strongest memory was of this man that lived in the woods behind my grandmother's house. A man that, it was almost like a fairy tale. And telling it, I realized it sounded like a fairy tale. This, you know, at the time when I was living it, I didn't think it was a fairy tale. It was just my life. But then, you know, from a distance, all the pieces of a fairy tale. He lived alone in the house. He was, maybe call him a hermit almost. And my grandmother warned that if I got too close to the house, he would come out with a shotgun and shoot me, that you couldn't go near his house. And the summer I was 7, which was my daughter's age, when I heard he'd come out and shoot me with a shotgun, when I heard that he'd shoot me with rock salt, so it probably wouldn't kill me, but it would sting, which isn't true at all. I mean, rock salt could kill you also. But when I heard that, it was suggested it might not kill me, I decided that was a good way to spend my summer. So I spent that summer trying to get as close as I could to this person's house. And that was the original title of the book. His name was Mr. Mann, M-A-N-N. He was the last living relative of one of the oldest families in our town. And his house is like one of the oldest houses in our town. It's an old town. So the house, I believe, was from 1636. It had been continuously lived in by the same family for, you know, all those years. And now it's a museum. So the book sort of began at this structure. I would go back, I would tell my daughters the stories of Mr. Mann. It turned out we'd ended up, just by coincidence, I guess, like me finding myself in Brooklyn every May. My wife would be away at work, out of town work. I had a gig in Boston. I had to do a reading or some event in Boston, and we had no childcare. So I'd just get in the car with my daughter and we'd drive. And then we'd end up going to my hometown and I'd show her the places where the stories I was telling her took place. And we got to sort of see them. And that's really like the structure of the book. It sort of just organically arose from these 3 trips over 3 years.
And did that trigger more memories?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It kept sort of building on it. Like one would lead to the other. Like, because then when she got older, when she got to be 8, she would ask me what I did. And I would say, well, that's after we moved out of the house. You know, the title of the book is now, This is the Night Our House Will Catch Fire. And the house that we moved out of, the house that caught fire, the new house we moved into, I had to walk to school, or I chose to walk to school. I chose a very long way to walk to school, which is through a salt marsh in our town. Our town was on the ocean, you know, a small town in Massachusetts on the ocean. And I chose as a child to walk, and it was quite far to walk. I mean, it was probably a couple miles. And it was really arduous, like the salt marsh. Like I went back in with my daughter and we were filthy. And like within half an hour, we were completely filthy. Like I must have showed up at school, like just like, I mean, in like second grade, 8 years old is about second grade. And I must have shown up at school just completely filthy every day. Like it's sort of incomprehensible to me. Like, because I'm lucky I even made it there with my shoes, because you'd fall into muck and you have to pull your shoes out. Sometimes you'd lose a shoe. I don't know. I can't really imagine what I looked like. Coming to school after walking through a salt marsh like every day.
Well, I'm 11 years younger than you. And I remember my childhood would be described now as abject child neglect. And
sorry to hear that.
It was one of the greatest possible ways of growing up. You know, like I, the town I lived in, Coral Springs, which is next door to Parkland, where the high school shootings took place. It was just this nondescript suburb that had all of these mysteries, because if you spend enough time in a place, you know, it becomes magical because it becomes yours through walking through it. And sure, bad things could have happened.
Yeah.
But I think so much of my sense of independence came from just walking everywhere.
Yeah, that was my experience too as a child. Like, you know, it wasn't the same as it is now. So kids were allowed, or just for circumstance, maybe just my, I don't know if all kids were like, I was especially independent or especially allowed to wander because my mother was working three jobs often. And it just wasn't, you know, we're often alone in the house and we'd often just, she would leave us, you know, $2 on the counter to go get our dinner at the sub shop, you know, when we were like, you know, 6 years old, and just, it was so exciting. My daughter actually, like, you know, when I told her that story, like, we'd go, the sub shop is still there. It opened like right when, you know, we like moved into this town. And I was born in that town, but like it opened around the same time I was born, the sub shop, and it's still open now by the same owners, which is just sort of like mind boggling to me. These two brothers opened it, and I can't believe, like, I'm old and they're still, like, how would they do, like, how old are they? It also seems like sort of a fairy tale also that, like, this. And so I bring her there. I get to bring my daughter to the sub shop. It's called Maria's. And I do feel, to me, the food there is like mother's milk to me. Like, I need to sort of have one of those subs every day, every year. Once a year, I have to go sort of like just, you know, taste one again. But my daughter was very upset when when I told her the story that when she was about seven, we were driving back from my hometown the first time, and she was in the back seat, and she was just sort of like really upset. She's like, you know, you had so much, you got to do so much more when you were a kid. You got to get dinner on your own. She was really upset that she didn't get to go just walk through Brooklyn to go buy her dinner. Then I started to let her do that more. I started to, you know, ended up giving her a walkie-talkie, and she would like walk around our neighborhood with a walkie-talkie. So she would like, you know, which, you know, probably in these days, you know, some like, you know, over-concerned parent might have turned me into the police or something, like to let a six-year-old or a seven-year-old walk, you know, walk around the block unattended. But, you know, I just felt it was really important for her to get that sense of like that the world is a big place and you can make your way through it. You know, like, you know, there's interesting things. Now she's like really into like just explore. She's 12 now. She's really into exploring the city. You know, she has a skateboard now, and she, you know, she took herself to dinner. We left her in Brooklyn for a week just this past week, and she would skateboard around and take herself to dinner and meet a friend and go for walks. And it's just great. I mean, I don't want to be the person, you know, a parent that, you know, she's 12. I mean, she's old enough to do this. So, yeah.
So, yeah, the town that you're talking about, what's the name of the town?
Yeah, it's hard to pronounce probably. So I'll say it for you.
Situate,
Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yes. So as a New England town, pretty much any old house is going to look like it could be out of a fairy tale. Which doesn't mean that it doesn't work for the story, but
except our houses, because we were so poor that, you know, my mother was just a young, you know, she was like 20 years old, and she was single with two kids, and she had no money. So we bought the, you know, shittiest houses in town. Like, she bought one when she was 25, and I've gone to visit both of these houses that we lived in. Two houses before that, we just lived in like on people's couches and like in like little rentals for like a couple months, like for all over town. And then she bought a house when she was 25 and I was 5 years old, the house that, you know, caught fire. And I've gone to visit these houses. I've gone to visit both the houses that she bought since. And both of them told me, the people that live in the houses now, both told me as soon as they moved in, the building department came over and said, you can't live in this house. It's condemned. Both houses have the same story. They're still like, it's sort of amazing. They're still standing, but just people like us would buy them and move in because they were like the cheapest, most rundown houses in town. And so a certain type of person moves in. And I really like those people. Like, the people that live in those two houses, like, I immediately understood them. We understood each other as soon as I met them. So
trying to creep into the middle class.
But buying those houses is not the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, these are the kind of houses that, you know, you buy them for $10,000 and then 2 years after you've dumped like $5,000 in, you could sell it for like maybe $9,000, you know? So
it occurs to me, maybe one of the reasons why you write so many memoirs is that the things that are inspiring the memoirs would be difficult to believe in fiction.
That maybe is an impulse. I'm not sure if I have the affective impulse like to create the world. I'm sort of like really interested in the physics of the natural world and cause and effect and, you know, action and consequence, and which all those things can play out in fiction, of course, but I'm really interested in actually looking at what has happened and trying to see like my perception of what happened and see how accurate that is, and trying to sort of move more and more towards some bringing those two things together. Like, you know, I live in a world of, you know, an interior world. There's like, you know, speculation and emotion and feelings and my perceptions of things. And then there's something else happening. There's things that actually happened in the world. And I'm just really interested in that tension between those two things. And so far I write things that have elements of fiction in them. Like, you know, in this book, in the new book, and, you know, This Is the Night Our House Will Catch Fire. There's moments where I get to go back and talk to Mr. Man while he's dying, the night he's dying. I get to be in the room with him the night he's dying to try to, like, you know, get some closure with that relationship, even though he and I never spoke. But he was a very important person in my life, and I get to go back. So I get to do fictive things within the memoir, but it's sort of clear that they're my speculations on those things, I would hope. I would hope no one would actually think that I actually did go back when I was 7 years old and sit in the room with him while he was dying.
Well, that would be a bad reader, because you do have a note at the beginning of the book saying when stuff like this happens, that's how it ended up in the book.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've tried to write memoir from time to time, and I just find it really difficult. And one of the reasons is trying to get that balance right of persuading people, no, this happened. I remember I gave it an essay to a colleague, and he's like, oh, yeah, no, this it's not believable. You have to rewrite this. I'm like, no, that happened. That was a thing that, like, my life could be that bad.
That was my first experience with my first book of poetry that came out, which came out 20 years ago this year. And in it, I had my father. I touched on my father's homelessness, like him being homeless. There's a few poems that talk about, you know, my father being homeless. Most of the feedback I got from that, from people that didn't know me, was that, like, you know, there would be questions even in interviews, like, so how did you come up with the how'd you come up with the archetype of the homeless father? Or how'd you come up with this sort of, you know, that how'd you create this fictional homeless father? And I was like, no, my father really was homeless. But it just felt so pitiful in a way to have to defend that, to have to say, like, because, you know, you can understand that in a poem, things don't have to line up with reality. I could have created an archetype of a homeless father. I mean, I could have done that. I, you know, there's not a rule in poetry that says you can't. You know, I mean, King Lear is a, you know, a homeless father. I mean, it's like, you know, and I don't think we assume that Shakespeare had a homeless father. But then there was something about that debunked, like you just said, like no, this really happened. Like that phrase is so sad. It's such a sad. You have to make that assertion, like, no, this really happened. So the one way to get around that, I thought, was to write a memoir that I would actually have, like, no. You have to lay it out really clearly, like, you know, this is how my father became homeless. And it seemed like a very hard thing for people to keep in their heads, even. You know, the word homeless and the word father, like, it was just hard. People sort of, their eyes would glass over and they'd sort of look away and they didn't want to take that in. So, yeah, so, you know, I wrote the book in some ways just a response to the reaction to the first book of poetry.
Because you didn't want to field those questions anymore.
Yeah, I didn't have to want to keep answering that question. So I did it just to answer that question. So that was the use of that question was actually quite good, because it, you know, it got me to realize, like, oh, people are going to just be able to actually still put this aside and say, oh, this didn't really happen. You know, that this doesn't happen to people like us or something, you know, whatever they think.
You know. Well, I think it also points to, you know, one of the things that makes you relatively unique as a writer, which is that as a writer of literature, you don't have the pedigree. There are, you know, like, I'm guessing there have never been finger sandwiches in your life unless you know, like it was at a conference or something. And, you know, I grew up as a blue collar kid. And so just the idea like, oh, I'm going to write literature. It's like, well, there's certainly a class divide, I think, that happens between people who that's a natural path for them. And then, you know, people from more humble backgrounds who look at literature and they say, no, I need this. This is for me. And I think the immediacy and the roughness of life sometimes is a shock to people who come from a more comfortable background who expect literature to be behind glass or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But also when I was a kid, you know, when I was studying literature, you know, I went to UMass, you know, eventually in order to, you know, study English. And the books that I was drawn to were really books that sort of like did speak to like a working class like existence, like, you know, Tilly Olson's book of short stories, would Tell Me a Riddle. I remember that being just hugely important to me. Grace Paley, James Baldwin, these folks that would not have the same, you know, pedigree. But then again, I also think that if you think back to like, you know, older, like other systems that were in place, like in other eras, like think about a patronage system. Like there was the aristocracy that would support the artist because they were like the entertainment. And so I sort of at some points, I kind of appreciated that thing because then at least the workers would actually be making the art, would be doing the thing. And the rich people would just be doing whatever the rich people do. They would be supporting them. Like, you know, like Caravaggio is supported by the state, you know, he's like allowed to sort of create.
But now I think it's Shakespeare where he has to make sure, okay, let me not piss the bosses off while I do the thing I can't help myself from doing.
Exactly. Or he has to figure out a language where he can just insert all that stuff into it. That they're not even going to notice actually criticizing them, you know? And I think it does create has created an interesting tension over the years. I mean, I think a big, you know, terrible thing is that like now, like the, you know, the wealthy people have decided that they want to create art too. And it just, you know, it generally makes some pretty terrible art, but they should just keep funding the artists, I think. I mean, for the most part.
So can you talk about working with Norton and, you know, how finalizing this book worked?
Oh, sure. I've been with Norton now for 16 years. My first book came out, for 20 years, really, because it took me, they bought the book, Another Bullshit Night in Sex City, about 20 years ago. And then it took me another 4 years to finish it. And for it to come out. So I've been working there with Jill Bielaski as my editor for like 20 years now. And, you know, this is our fourth book together. You know, I'm really it's really fortunate to have that like long relationship with someone. We know each other and she knows she's seen all the drafts. I mean, the drafts of all my books are like, you know, they're even like, I'm not like someone who, I forget who those, there's some writers that just like drop the draft in they're it's pretty much finished when they give it to them. But Jill and I work a lot. Like I give her a lot of work to do. I bring in drafts that are sort of rangy and, you know, messy and, you know, with like things that just, you know, are never going to make it into the final book. And so she's seen a lot and a lot of things that are also really, you know, probably cringeworthy too. Like I'm very glad they haven't made it into the final books because they're, you know, I allow myself because I trust her as an editor. And so it allows me to really be vulnerable in the drafts, like emotionally and take risks. And then you sort of distill it and refine it into the final book. And it's not to, I don't think it's to take the energy away from it. It's actually to concentrate the energy. And also the thing too, to know that, you know, maybe this tangent I'm going off in, since we have this long relationship, maybe that'll just become another book, like, you know, 5 years down the road. You know, it doesn't have to just, it's not wasted energy. It's just maybe right. It doesn't fit in this book, you know? And so, yeah. And so this Burning House has appeared in every one of the books I've written in some way. There's a fire, at least, and the fire to me is always sort of goes back to this Burning House. My first book of poems begins with a poem, Bag of Mice, and that poem is about a dream I had. It came from a dream. So the first thing I ever, like, you know, published in book form has a burning, these six baby mice in a bag, in a paper bag that's on fire, which is basically, you know, the shape of a house. I mean, if you look at the cover of the book, it could be the shape a paper bag makes when you sort of like fold it up and set it on fire. And that was you know, an unconscious association I had. I didn't like really, you know, take that in. Although in the book, there's also mentions of jumping out of a burning house and things like that. So,
when you had mentioned to me that the bit I had you read at the beginning has appeared in a different form in The Ticking is the Bomb, it seems to me like there are all of these different connections between all of your memoirs, which is partly the thrill of This Is the Night Our House Will Catch Fire for Nick Flynn fans. It feels weird saying fans of memoirs because it means we're gobbling up your traumatic life and, you know, the wise and vulnerable ways that you write about it. But it seems like there's this, you know, giant new vein of narrative that has come out that we kind of had fragments of in your previous work. You know, this is a meditation about your mother and among other things. You know, this seems like an example of what you're talking about, where a little bit from previous books turned into, you know, just a book that's as great as any that you've written.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for that. I've been doing a slow read these days with a reporter based who's works for the Houston Chronicle. And we just, like, in the middle of COVID, we just decided to do a slow read of Moby Dick, a book that I've read. This will be my second or third time reading it through, but I hadn't read it for quite a while. I'm just seeing it with different eyes, and I'm seeing how Melville put it together. And like each chapter, I can almost see that he wrote it. Like there'll be a chapter, and then he'll say, in the previous chapter, there's something I couldn't really talk about fully, but I'd like to go into it more deeply now. And there's one moment that happens, and it's just like this beautiful moment, and he'll expand on one moment, and then he'll say, yeah, there's another thing. I have to go back a little bit, and you can see like each thing is building on what came before it, which just seems he's showing us the process of doing it. I just think it's like really, really beautiful. I just keep noticing that lately in the reading of Moby Dick. So
he's directing traffic.
He's directing traffic, but he's also showing us the process, like how he wrote it. He's showing us like you know, he would read, like, I just imagine him writing a chapter, because it's all broken into, you know, it was very much the blueprint for my first book of my first memoir was Moby Dick, like the structurally. But I'd read it, but I sort of got one thing out of it, which was that you can just create something out of small pieces. Like he'll focus in on, this is the eye of the whale. This is how you render a whale. This is the whiteness of the whale. Like each thing is just a discrete piece that he just goes deeply into, like with pure description and then like a philosophical reflection on it. And that's sort of building around this whole central mystery. That was exciting. But now, like reading it, I'm seeing like how he built it, which was like by really like reading those pieces over and saying like, okay, I didn't quite get it. I didn't get all of it. I'm going to add a little bit more to it. I'm going to go deeply into this one thread that was just like hinted at and then made bigger. That's just reminding me of what you just said about what you noticed about my work. So I appreciate that. I don't mind sitting on the, a tiny figure on the shoulder of Herman Melville makes me very happy.
So I imagine writing your memoirs get to be painful. And I wonder if, when you finish a book, if there's a sense of closure. Like I doubt absolute closure, but a sense of, okay, I think I understand some of these things better, and new memoirs that come out in my life will be about different things maybe.
Yeah, I don't know, like, you know, who knows if, you know, what'll come next or if anything will. You know writing is a very mystical process, really, like that anything comes out is like, especially these days, it just feels like I'm not as willful in my writing. I sort of allow things to happen more than will them into being. I'm not as obsessive as I once was. I'm more like meditative. So I just sort of wait for things to happen. And, you know, this book was like probably the hardest to write on a psychic, spiritual, emotional level for me. But that just meant that that's what I was going through in my life. Like at that moment, the moment of creation of this book in my life, it's hard to say which, did I summon that chaos by writing the book, or was the chaos there and it sort of like led me to try to like make some sense of it by writing? It's hard to say, really. The two were sort of like really neck and neck. That I became suddenly like aware in this way that I hadn't been of something I'd been aware of my whole life, which was that in all likelihood, my mother set our house on fire. Like that's the thing that like is sort of, it's talked about in maybe in definitely in The Ticking is the Bomb, I believe, maybe even in another bullshit 960. It's talked about, but at that time when I wrote those books, I was younger. I didn't have a daughter. And I sort of looked at my mother as a heroic figure in a way, which I still think she is in many ways. I mean, if that's, you know, not to over-dramatize it, but, you know, she was a young woman who made her way with two kids alone. It wasn't, there weren't divorced people in our town when I was growing up. She was like, you know, fiercely independent. And she figured out a way. She set the house on fire in order to get insurance money because the house was a shitbox. And this was a way to fix it up and to make our life a little better. You know, that Christmas, you know, I had some better toys, you know, like for the first time. There was like, you know, I talk about that in the book. There was a tape recorder, which was just ridiculously extravagant for us. So she got some money from this thing. And then it wasn't until I was, my daughter was seven, was the age I was, you know, a year older. But it was, I think the psychic rumblings were happening like all around then, you know, for a couple of years before that, because the book was sort of rumbling into being. And it wasn't until I saw her and saw how big you are, tiny you are and vulnerable you are when you're six and seven. Because I felt like I was an adult when I was seven. And I felt like I was, you know, I was out in the woods by myself all day long and just like, you know, trying to taunt a guy with a shotgun and shoot me. And,
yeah, your grandma would say, don't get into trouble.
Yeah.
Be back by six. Yeah.
Be back before dark from the woods. I just go into the woods and I ended up breaking into his house when I was like, you know, 7 years old, like breaking into a guy's house with a shotgun. Like now I think like, that is nuts. That is nuts. But
no, you know, it's the beginning plot of so many horror movies is what you did every afternoon.
Yeah. But just seeing that suddenly the ground metaphorically fell out from beneath me when I suddenly said like, wait a minute, that was really a reckless thing my mother did. To set our house on fire with two kids inside it was like incredibly reckless and something I would never do. Like I was like, you don't set a house on fire with kids in it. Like that's like, that's a little too far. That's going a little too far. Even if you're going to get a couple $1,000 in insurance money or whatever the fuck it was, because it couldn't have been more than that because the house, she bought the house for $2,000. So it could have been more than $2,000. So, yeah, so that's sort of like precipitated, you know, the psychic breakdown. And it was just something I had to go through. I had to face it, though. It's just something I had to sort of look at, you know, take out of the whatever realm of protective bubble I had kept that in and had to take it out and just sort of look at it very clearly, you know, with a lot of help, you know, therapists and 12-step meetings and, you know, meditation practices and, you know, my entire, you know, incredibly elaborate network of things that keeps me from like going off the rails.
And in this, you know, reckoning with your mother as a mother, you know, I mean, there's that respect of like, how is it possible that she did what she did in good and bad ways? And one of the constants, I think, in your memoirs is you're quite often, you're not good in how you behave. And
yeah, well, no, and
you don't spare yourself.
But in Bullshit Night, I'm actually in another Bullshit Night. I'm actually, that's the first book. I'm actually like sort of a scrappy. The character of Nick Flynn, you know, the presentation of self, the performance of self is I'm a scrappy young person who, you know, rough things happen to, but in the end, I persevere. You know, and then I sort of had to put that down and say like, well, okay, this is what really life is like. So from then on, no, I've exposed like terrible things I do. Yeah.
And it also involves people who care about you and people who are close to you. So does that require courage or really great patience on behalf of the people close to you? Or
yeah, I can't really speak, you know, for how people close to me, you know, survive with me. You'd have to ask them that question. you know, I'm sure like it can be difficult at times. Hopefully there's some rewards also. You know, one of the things you're touching on is that you know, part of the book, one of the threads of the book is that what happened at the same time I had to face my mother, the reality of what my mother had done was I was having an affair. And, you know, it's not something that I am, you know, proud of. Yet at the time, perhaps like my mother, I felt utterly justified in it. It just made sense. It was like a sort of a survival thing. There was many good things that came out of the affair in this sort of strange, you know, shadowy netherworld, which affairs exist in. And there was damage. There was a lot of damage. And it's, you know, those are consequences I've had to reckon with since. And part of, you know, the book was begun when the affair had ended, and, you know, I'd come clean about it, and, you know, there'd been a lot of, like, you know, repair to do. You know, part of the book was also to look at that, to see, you know, what I had done and why I had done it, and why, like, sort of having, like, a secret place I could go to, knowing that it was causing damage, like, even if it was, you know, unacknowledged, or, you know, but why that seemed to be a necessary in some way. You know, so I've done a lot of work on that since in the, you know, in the last like 5 years, which has been, yeah, which has been hard, but it's been also neck and neck. So that's a thread that goes through the book also, like a parallel thread, like me at that moment in my life, when I'm sort of suddenly realizing that what my mother did might not have been the best thing to do, and looking at myself and saying, yeah, and what I'm doing right now is not the best thing to do, or what I did, what I had recently, you know, just was emerging from, the self I was emerging from.
Well, it was a deliberate way to compartmentalize your life in some ways while you tried to deal with things, even though closing things off was creating new problems.
It wasn't really, you know, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone as a, you know, it's sometimes you can convince yourself at the time, you know, and this is just like, you know, you can convince yourself of a lot of things, but it just hurt. It hurt everyone involved. And I, you know, I it's not something that I'm would want to return to, that self that sort of lived in, that could live a double life, you know? So
I told you before we started the interview that, the one memoir I haven't fully read is the reenactments about the filming of Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, which I listened to. The audiobook's like 5.5 hours, something like that, maybe 4. And I've listened to all of it, but not while I was awake. And I need to have some audio going on in the bedroom when I sleep because of my tinnitus, because of AC/DC, because I was stupid. And one thing I was really curious about is you have a cameo in Bing Flynn at an AA meeting in which, right, Paul Dano plays you as a young man, and then there's you. So how did it feel like to not be you in a scene with you?
Well, they sort of tricked me into that cameo. They just put me in a chair. I mean, the camera's just on me, so there's no one else actually in the circle of the I think it was technically an NA meeting. They just said, so what would someone say if they're in the situation? They just sort of like, you know, just improvise something. And then, you know, I can't believe they ended up using it, actually. Whenever I see it, you know, the times I've seen that the film, my mind goes completely white when I appear and I don't see anything. So I just erased myself. So there were, you know, Paul Dano had hair and makeup. He had like a, you know, someone with costume people. I'd just gotten off my bike and I was just like a mess, you know. It didn't seem quite fair, but yeah, it was a really, you know, a surreal experience to have. You know, they're actually on set. There were actually like at least like 3 Paul Danos. I mean, 3 Nick Flynns, maybe more, because there was like a body double, and they'd walk around with a little thing on it, like Nick Flynn. They have a little badge on that said Nick Flynn. Paul Dano was Nick Flynn. There was a trailer when I first got there. It was being filmed in the East Village in New York, and there's a trailer on the street that said Nick Flynn at the door, and I went to go in it and somebody stopped me and said, that's not you. So it was very sort of like Hall of Mirror-y type place. It seems like there was one more Nick Flynn. I can't quite remember, but there were quite a few Nick Flynns.
Well, that was
like
the younger, you know, actor. Like younger Nick Flynn.
There's the younger Nick Flynn. Yeah. So that's it. Yeah. 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 There might even been another one. I don't know. So there were a lot. Yeah. There was like a little Being John Malkovich type thing, you know?
Well, and it seems like this was a really unusual situation, because quite often, right, when a writer's work is adapted, they might be on set one day as like a favor to the writer. And instead, this seemed like it was much more collaborative from what I can tell.
Yeah, we worked a lot. Paul Weitz is the screenwriter and director, and he and I worked for 7 years on the script, where he would send me every draft of it. He wrote 30 drafts of it. He'd send me every draft. I'd send him notes back. We'd, you know, really sort of, then we'd get notes in from the studios and have to adapt those or see. And yeah, it really felt collaborative. I've done a lot of collaboration in my life. Like, I've worked, this part of my process is working with other people. And so I think he sort of recognized that. Like, I think most writers are not allowed on set. Like, they just don't want you on set.
You're not wanted. Yeah.
No, we don't want any. But Paul saw that I could be, I don't have the same ego thing about like, this is my work. You know, it was clearly like, at this point, I'd give it, my book still exists, and this is a movie. This is something else. And what can I do to help this movie? And I really saw, because I didn't try to change like how, you know, Paul Dano played me or try to like make me look better or, you know, anything like that. I decided just to focus on trying to have the homeless, you know, those that were staying in a homeless shelter or sleeping on the streets portrayed in a way that wasn't stereotyped. That seemed to be like the best thing I could, because most films I'd seen that had like, you know, quote unquote homeless people in them, it just, they fell into these like sort of horrible stereotypes that really like were really painful to watch. And I just really wanted that not to happen in this film. So that was really what I focused on.
Yeah. And so in some ways, because the big studios eventually fell away, that actually helped the movie.
I think so. Yeah. The script got, I mean, you know, I don't, the script got pretty bad with all the fingers from the big studios. All every vice president would stick their thumb into it and suggest something, and it just got to be really like unreadable. And because they kept wanting to make my father nicer, like more user friendly, they wanted him to be like a, you know, they didn't want him to be so racist, they didn't want him to be so homophobic, they didn't want him to be so, they wanted him to be like more heroic, like this work guy. I'm like, he's just a guy who's like, you know, lost, and he's like he does terrible things, but he still deserves, you know, our compassion, you know, is my thing. Like you can't just sort of like try to make him better so that we like him more. Like that seemed to be like really, I don't understand that. I mean, I just don't think that's not what we do. but that's what the script had become. And it became like slowly, like, you know, death by a thousand cuts. Like you sort of say like, yeah, okay, you could soften that a little. Okay, you could make this. And it just made no sense at all. Like, you're like, why is this guy, why is he in this situation? He's not even an alcoholic. Like my father was like an alcoholic. And when he got drunk, he said terrible things, you know, and he was abusive, and he was like, you know, and it's just the reality of it. It doesn't, you know, and I have deep compassion for him. You know, I've been, you know, I struggled with drugs and alcohol myself. I know what that is, you know, it's like, so it's good. I'm really glad we got to go back to an original script, an earlier script, but all the stuff we had learned from the other scripts got to be sort of incorporated in the good stuff, which is, you know, more the darker thing. It sort of read more like a, you know, a really strange, like Eastern European art house movie, really. Like, you know, like something, you know, from the Eastern Bloc or something. Like, it's just like darkness. Like, you know.
You know, it just works really well as a movie, which looking at that book, like I wouldn't think, oh, that should be a movie like that. Like there are scenes that are like vivid, you know, but like as a whole, like a start to finish movie, it seemed like it's a long shot that it would be good. And so it really required just the perfect script to be able to capture something like the essence of the book and still just work like a movie, because like they're two very different media, they're almost different languages.
He had a hell of a time like adapting the script. I mean, I remember going to his, you know, his studio in Hollywood or in LA, you know, early on when he was trying to like map out the book, and it really was like, you know, beautiful mind territory. It was just like sort of, he had like just things in the walls and then spring connecting them, and like this scene leads to this. And I couldn't really even help him through it. Like I couldn't, like, I'm like, you know, I think there's 80 something chapters in it, and they go and some of them connect, and there's some central scenes that I think are central scenes and some that he thinks are central scenes. And, you know, some things were changed obviously with the script too. Like they decided, which I was initially uncomfortable with, but I really like, as long as the homeless aren't stereotyped, I'll go along with most things. You know, one was that I'd bring my father in the film. I bring him into where I'm living and give him a bed for the night. And I never did that. You know, I never took my father in. I took other homeless people in with disastrous consequences usually. So, but, you know, I was very confused and it was a very difficult time. And that seemed important for me to put that in the book too. Now, you know, I helped him a lot. And his argument was that I helped him a lot after he got into housing. I helped him get into housing. I maintained him in housing for like 16 years. Got him in was part of the transition of him into a long-term care facility. You know, so I took care of him for those years afterwards. I did, you know, a lot to do that. And he said, we're just going to sort of, just so you don't look like a total dick, you know, like recognize that at that moment you couldn't take him into your home but then you did a lot afterwards, you know? So you just sort of, there's like the magic of Hollywood, like having me do that. So
he got a compressed time.
He also had, in the film also, like suddenly I somehow managed to figure out how to like get my father off the street into a hotel, get married, have a child and write a book all within seemingly like about a year. Like I don't age at all. And I'm wearing the same jacket. And suddenly I'm like, I have a child, I have a wife, I have a, like, you know, and all those things took, each one of those things took me like a decade to figure out. Each one was like a decade of my life to figure each one of those things out.
Well, I remember thinking, yeah, that ending, it is a Hollywood ending. And that's not what I felt when I watched it, which is the important part.
No, it was good. I think the ending was good. Like, I liked the ending too. It was just funny that it was, the time was so compressed.
Yeah,
no,
like, you get closure for like four different stories.
I mean, it literally took me 10 years to write my first book of poetry, you know, like, you know, from start to finish, you know. So that I could have written it in a year is like, you know, hopefully no one actually believes that part of it. You know, someone who's trying to write, say like, how did he get married, have a child, get his father off the streets and write a poetry book in a year?
Well, a lot of speed. He didn't sleep. No. Well, can you talk about those 10 years?
Of writing the book, the first book?
Yeah. I mean, was that a case of finding your voice or finding the confidence to believe like, no, like I'm a writer, this is a thing? Or?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I published my first book when I was 40. And yeah, up until then, like, you know, to say I was a writer was pretty much entering into the land, which I think most young writers have to become comfortable with, of delusion, that you're basically, you know, people look at you a little like you say you're a writer, but you're not really. You just sit in your pajamas like the days you don't work and just sort of like hope something happens and do the best you can and, you know, get frustrated and, you know, try to find your way through. So I spent a lot of time. The main thing of those 10 years was that I had quit drinking and doing drugs. Like that was the biggest change. And that came at the beginning of that, like right at the end of my 20s. And that's when I began writing. And that was why I quit drinking and doing drugs initially. That's what I thought. I thought it was to like, just so I could write. But then it turned out to be much bigger than that.
So you can retain the discipline?
Well, and just so I could be a human being, not an animal, you know? So, you know, tied into everything. Like my relationship to addiction is like, you know, one of the central things in my life is that like, that's something I have to really keep in the forefront. Like that, you know, if I give into my addictions, bad things happen. So that was a really big part of it. And so, and then sort of like just finding my way into like a writing community, but it was really a writing community that was just based on friendships and attraction and, you know, common like bonds. And so, I mean, I just had a dear friend of mine over, one of my first teachers from that time is Marie Howe, poet. I ended up taking a workshop at her dining room table with like 10 of us sitting around the thing, you know, right when I quit drinking. And she was over at my house last night. We've stayed friends like for these, like, you know, what is that? That's 30 years, you know, dear friends. You know, it's really that. It was really like that, like just sort of like whatever like connected us. And we saw like something in each other, which is just really, really profound and beautiful. It's like this, you know, there's a beautiful community. You find your own tribe, you know, you find your own branch on the tree of literature and you sort of find those people that are speaking to you and that you get moved by. And, you know, maybe I'm lucky, but I just think it's kind of the way it is. Like you're usually they're decent people and you get to like, you have some sort of like a connection with them. So.
And they help the delusion seem more realistic.
Well, they do sort of show you that there's something possible. I just was trying to write. I didn't know why I was trying to write poetry. Like it wasn't like to publish a book or to go to grad school or to like, you know, to be on a podcast with John King, you know, it wasn't like to do any of those things. It was like, just cause I was
my
fascinated.
Podcast is old. It's not that old.
I mean, in the future, like to have your aspiration.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, I knew it didn't exist at that point, but I imagined it into being. It was mostly just, I was fascinated by language and by what language could do and that I would read things. I would be moved in a way that was very particular, that was very like, and it really was about emotional energy. It really was for me, art is about how to navigate emotional energy. And that's where I'd find like some of the, my richest emotional experiences, you know, beyond a connection with another human being would be, you know, through specifically poetry. And there were just poets that I read at that time when I was first coming up that like, I would just still be in awe of. I'd be in awe of and not like know how they did it. It was a mystery. It was such a great mystery how you could do in like a discompressed form. You could just have this energy in it that would just like, you know, connect to the universe. I was just, you know, I'm still in awe of that really.
Well, I hope you never lose it. And when you yourself write something great and people ask you, how did you do that? The answer is usually, I don't know.
Well, it is a matter of like sort of a daily practice, I think. I mean, that's the, sort of what I could say. I think all of life is a daily practice. It's like you get up, like being married is a daily practice. It's not like, well, now I'm married, I can cross that off my list. You know, like, you know, now I just get to, you know, just do something else. Like it's you know, the things you want to cultivate in your life, you have to attend to them and find space for them and figure out how they, and it's joy. I get great joy out of writing also. It's a big thing too. It's like, you know, I try to go toward things that bring me like, you know, some sort of joy, which I do think is like, you know, sort of the natural state of the universe is joy in some way. And so I try to move toward those things. Like the shit show state of the universe seems a lot of times produced from within my own psyche, you know, although there, of course there are terrible things happening all over the world, but there's also things we can do about them. And there's positive change we can make. And, you know, so it's that. So,
well, when I said we don't know like how we did it, yeah, partly it is making sure, right, you put your ass in the chair and give yourself the opportunity to be there when, you know, your unconscious kind of releases some great stuff, and trying to make sure that, you know, what you ultimately publish mostly just has the good stuff in it.
Yeah. That's a good thing. Yeah. I'm all about the D.W. Winnicott thing of good enough these days. you know, like I'm not looking for perfection. I'm looking for like, okay, this is what it wants to be. Like each of my books is sort of what it wants to be.
That was a phrase that was very helpful to me working on my dissertation. As someone else had said of a dissert, like some days good enough just has to be good enough. Because if you couldn't graduate until you felt like everything was great and perfect, no one would ever graduate.
No, it's really important. And I think good enough is perfect. So, you know.
So as a memoir writer, do you ever get moments in your life where you're experiencing it, but maybe have an out of body experience thinking, like anticipating that this is going to be part of your writing?
Yeah. I try to do that less and less. Like there's a thing I said like a little while ago, a few years ago, where I just, people asked me what I was working on. I said, I'm working on not writing. I'm really trying not to write. and that was just because like, I really felt like that my experience for 20 years or, you know, at that point, 25 years or some like huge chunk of my life, I had always been sort of like doing that, like sort of like everything was sort of being translated into this abstraction of language and how do I contain it and do this, like every experience. It was just sort of like this strange simulacrum you're moving through. And it felt like that it wasn't really living. And I thought like, okay, what if I just don't write? What if I don't write? And what I meant by don't write was like, I would write, but I got a couple of some residencies and I could go away for a month and just really focus on something, dive into something deeply. Or even if I was home, I would just like spend a week and just really just like focus on it, like really be fully in it. And that'd be when I'd be completely immersed in it. And then when I put it down, I would forget about it. I would just leave and not look at it again for 2 months. And in those 2 months was what I felt like was like, that's when I'm really alive. And I'm really like actually, you know, because being in a relationship with someone, with anyone, like if everything is being translated, if one of your experiences is being translated into language, you're just not really fully present with that person. And the whole point of this thing that we're doing, I think, is to try to be as conscious and present as possible.
Right.
I thought I could do it through writing, but I think you just do it by actually doing that. And the writing is like, you know, you try to bring that energy into the writing also. So I've tried to do that. So I think that the new book has a different energy like that, because it really came from that sort of like, you know, trying to just make it more about like actually the experience of being alive than about the experience of transforming experience into literature, if that makes sense.
Well, Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Nick Flynn, Aaron Lovett, and Alexander Pate. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, The Diaries of a Sawzold Scribbler as transcribed by Dimitri Konkmi, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. If you do like this show, please leave a positive review over at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you wrangle up your podcast queue. All right, gang. Until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Be always drunken. Nothing else matters. That is the only question. If you would not feel the horrible burden of time weighing on your shoulders and crushing you to the earth, be drunken continually. Drunken with what? With wine, with poetry, or with virtue, as you will, but be drunken.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.